Hello, and welcome to The Abstract, a podcast of conversations with the people who are creating the sights, sounds, and ideas that we all should be thinking a little bit more about. Today, our guest is Anthony Simpkins, a videographer and modern-day music historian out of Nashville, Tennessee. Anthony is the brainchild behind Gems on VHS, a YouTube channel and growing institution in Nashville. Gems on VHS features live, unplugged, raw performances from songwriters in the Americana and country music genres, and Anthony's been featured in Rolling Stone, who heralded him as spearheading a new wave of DIY Americana. He has a talent not only for discerning the ideal tone, setting, camera angles for a particular shoot, but also possesses a great sense of curatorial taste, working with rising artists who are defining a new brand of authentic roots and country music for a new generation. He does a great service to artists and fans alike, so let's dig in now with Anthony Simpkins on The Abstract. Well, hello, Anthony. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Justin. I know that we have been speaking for a long time via email and the occasional phone call working on this music industry stuff, and it's good to just have a conversation finally.
Yeah, absolutely. You do great work. You head up the site known as Gems on VHS, based out in Nashville, creating some amazing audio-visual content with artists who pass through.
Yeah, well, it started a long time ago as just an obsession that I had with the recordings of Alan Lomax, who is a 20th century folk icon who went around the country and eventually the world recording folk songs by all different people of all different walks of life, people that and cultures that he thought were underrepresented didn't really get a voice, and he went out there and just recorded the working people doing their songs. And also more contemporary things like Blogatech, which was a French blog that did these amazing takeaway shows, these offstage recordings. And I was watching a lot of those, and I just decided, hey, I have so many talented friends out here in Nashville. I want to start recording. And that's how it all began. And from there, it's grown into what it is now, which is millions and millions of views on YouTube and God bless somehow thousands of subscribers. So, you know, I'm amazed every day, and I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have it. So one thing that strikes me about your videos, like, I'm a big fan of live sessions, like, online of different bands playing, different artists playing their songs in different settings. But I think part of what makes Gems on VHS unique is you just have this eye or this good taste for picking alternative locations or alternative setups. I'm wondering, like, was that always part of the plan, or did you just find that was a more natural way to do it, or was it a matter of necessity?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because it's definitely the hardest part of the job, and I think if it was easier, more people would do it. You'd think that just filming anywhere would be an easy task, but it turns out to be a lot harder than you would think. And most of my inspirations, Alan Lomax, Blogatech, etc., you know, I just like things that aren't contrived, and a lot of those recordings, all of them, in fact, were all recorded wherever they were, you know, and that's just the best way to get it to me. So it started with just me filming people with no locations in mind, you know. It wasn't going to be something that we put together with a grand vision. It was just, hey, if you're on this street corner today, we'll shoot right there. You know, it really just is wherever, whenever, because that's not what it's about at the end of the day. It is, in a way. You know, it's about being natural and just being where the musician is. If I can film it in their living room, that's where I'm going to go, because that's where they're most at home, and that's where their song is going to be represented the best. So locations, I'd like to say I have an eye for it, you know. It definitely is partly where you place the camera, but at the end of the day, I'm really not doing the hard work. It's just kind of what was in front of us is what we filmed, you know, and I leave it to the world to present me with the beautiful options.
Yeah, it's a very naturalistic approach, and I see the Alan Lomax connection there. I mean, Lomax seemed to be one of the first people, or I guess it was his dad, John Lomax, too, who was almost the real progenitor, right? Of kind of just going out and finding folk recordings completely separate from any sort of, like, commercial or any other pretense in terms of staging,
and just kind of capturing what existed naturally. At least I think in the U.S. that was fairly, you know, that was unique for the time. So, you know, now it's like, well, everything's kind of a little bit staged. Everything is kind of packaged in some way, whether it's for YouTube, with what you're doing, or Instagram, or just, you know, for the business or a career. I'm wondering, like, are we losing something now without more options for naturally capturing this music by these undiscovered artists, or are we on the right track?
There's nothing new under the sun, Justin. I'll tell you what, Lomax, his father, John Lomax and Alan Lomax, went through the exact same problems when they were doing this. You know, you say that it wasn't staged. To be fair, a little bit of everything is staged, even back then. You know, they went around and recorded segments of society, prisons, etc., former slaves, that did not have a platform. And even then, when they went in there with the cameras and these giant recording rigs, you can bet it's a little bit staged. It wasn't just natural. And they did it not necessarily for free, although they did do it for the love of it, I'm sure. There was a whole business to it, going to the Library of Congress. Alan Lomax was big on cultural equity. He wanted everybody that he recorded to have a piece of the pie. And there was always a debate whether the cultures that they recorded were then brought into the mainstream, and you know, what was done to it there. There's a lot of that in anthropology. When you obviously record something, is that truly letting it thrive and survive as they wanted it to? They wanted these people to keep their culture, you know what I mean? They wanted the culture to thrive. They wanted it not to disappear. That's why they filmed it. But does it really thrive when you bring it into the mainstream by filming it? It's interesting, you know. In a 21st century aspect of that, with the whole YouTube thing, I mean, that's our platform. You know, that's where we bring it. Back in the day, you know, people like Pete Seeger had Rainbow Quest. There was lots of TV shows where you would bring music to the mainstream. The times have changed, but the idea is the same. We put it on YouTube, and there's a little theater to all kinds of music, you know, and that's the reality that the artists live in. You know, I try to film artists that are honest, that are writing songs for reasons that are not just commercial success. But at the end of the day, if it isn't practical, it doesn't make sense for them to do, and they can't do it. So what I do is I give them a platform that hopefully they can use to make money through album sales and everything like that. And I hope that answers a little bit of the question. I know it's a broad topic. Feel free to follow up with anything you think there.
Yeah, no, it does answer it. It sounds like there's a balanced approach, a sort of, you know, a way that you can do what you're doing and get as natural a performance and slice of life as possible, but also giving that slice of the pie that you mentioned. And that's interesting. I didn't really know that much about the realities there for Lomax. When it comes to YouTube itself, I guess just to transition into that, I'm curious how you're finding that platform and how it's evolved over the past few years. I think you'd know better than I. I mean, is it getting to be a less comfortable place for creators and companies like yourself?
Yeah, it's a very interesting world, online video. I mean, basically, it's just the new TV, right? So when I started with YouTube, it was some years ago now, 8 years ago, and it was kind of the Wild West days of YouTube. I mean, anything goes. You know, you would upload, it was just a place where you would upload videos, and that was the extent of the mission, really. I don't know if they had more of a mission at the time, but the reality of the situation was, if you had a video, YouTube would upload it. So nowadays, they've gotten really big, and I think when you consolidate that kind of power into one platform, you're obviously going to run into issues of morality, and the same can be said of Facebook and all the other social media platforms. But with YouTube in particular, in my experience, there's only good things to be said about it. I mean, it really puts the power in the hands of the people to make content and upload it to a global audience. I mean, there's never been a situation in the whole of humanity's existence on this earth where that was possible in the scale that it is now. And if you know how to use it and you don't mind working hard, there's going to be a lot that can be done with that, you know, and I've been blessed in that way. You know, I uploaded these videos, and somehow there was an audience. YouTube facilitated that. But now you have a lot of interesting conundrums that come up with that. I'm sure everybody knows by now, and it won't be new news by the time this goes out. You know, Alex Jones being deplatformed was a big piece, something really new, so that we had to consider. You know, obviously, I have no good things to say about Alex Jones. I think he's a lunatic. But it does lead to a lot of interesting conversations once you wonder, okay, they can just deplatform him on YouTube. They can just take it off, you know, and they removed him. You know, he had millions of views. He had lots of willing participants in his audience, and they took him off of there. Now, did they do a service to humanity? Probably, but that does leave a open door there for considering what's possible with our new media, the way media is presented to us, and how much freedom there really is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly not going to say anything in his defense either, but I understand the importance of the issue in terms of, like, okay, if they're going to do that to someone on the extreme end of things, which, you know, you could make a good argument that that was the right choice in that one case, perhaps, it sets the precedent that it can be done for lesser infringements or whatever. I don't even think he was the first. I think maybe he was just one of the more
prevalent, right? The biggest.
Yeah, or at least the loudest, you know, whatever. But, yeah, it is a concern. Loud. I mean, you don't appear to be doing anything that's necessarily rocking the boat, but, I mean, do you worry about that? Is that, like, a concern for
you?
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, well, because, you know, you might not think about it on the surface, but below the surface, there's a lot of YouTubers that talk about this kind of stuff where... a more relevant example is, I forgot his name. He's Logan, something Logan. He's one of those YouTubers, really
Logan
big YouTuber
Paul,
up
right?
there with Pew. That's right. That's it. The guy up there with PewDiePie is just like, he's one of the frontiersmen of vlogging. He's kind of this guy that has this huge audience of mostly really young people. And he uploaded a video, I'm sure you heard, he uploaded a video, a vlog, of him going to Japan, walking into the forest where many people kill themselves, and he finds a body, and he films himself walking up to the body, and he puts his own, you know, that's the show. I mean, you'd never see a TV show like that. You know, granted, there's all kinds of fictional TV shows like that, so it really leaves it up for interpretation where our morals really sit and how righteous they are, but in real life, that's frowned upon. So he walked up to a body and he filmed it and he put it on YouTube. Now, there's corporations like, you know, Ford, and they don't want to be associated with a video like that, but YouTube does not have the same control as Netflix does over what content goes onto it, or at least they didn't. And they try to put it all into an algorithm because they don't have the personnel. That's YouTube. YouTube is going to be the biggest platform, not the most controlled platform. So with their business model, it's all controlled by robots, you know, algorithms, numbers, equations, and those don't always have the human interest. Those don't always have the human element that you need sometimes. So, you know, just for example, I had a video flagged one time where me and Casper Allen, this very vulgar, hilarious artist, we were making a video in a bar, and he was drunk as hell, and I was pretty drunk too, if I was to be honest with you, and we were sitting in there goofing off about Twisted Tea, and it got flagged. I don't know why, but it got flagged. And you know, and that's the kind of stuff that you worry about as a content creator, that you put all this time into expecting it to go online. And the same thing with drug addiction and drugs. You know, a lot of my artists write about drugs, they write about addiction, they write true stories about, you know, their lives, and I would hate for some of my content to get flagged for that, and I don't believe that would be grounds for it, but I would not have a platform to dispute that, really. I mean, YouTube doesn't respond to disputes.
Okay, so you, on the one end, you got Logan Paul, who I guess is no Alex Jones, but like, I'm not really going to say much in his defense as like a cultural icon either. But nonetheless, like, you know, he's just kind of what he's making dippy stuff that's just like, you know, for younger kids and kind of being a jackass, I guess. But like,
couldn't tell you. I don't watch it either.
Yeah, but okay. So like, there's that, and then there's something like you were describing, which is like what you're doing. You know, you're talking about Alan Lomax. You're talking about you know, folklore and capturing like important cultural moments, and so some. What, some drunk talk works its way in there with the brand name, and like that's supposed to be as equally worthy of a flag as you know, finding a dead body and trying to make like some sort of moment around it. Like that's not equivalent, but I can totally see why in the eyes of the larger, you know, I don't know if it's an AI algorithm or what, or corporate censor, but
yeah,
those sort
it's
of
a
things,
little bit of both.
Yeah, that I see where it gets hairy, because those are objectively not equivalent when you look at them individually, but when you think about how they're having to scan through whatever trillions
they scan
amount
through
of videos.
Million, yeah, right, exactly. And you know what, robots are not yet our moral compasses yet, I'd say. And but you know what's interesting, Justin, there's nothing new under the sun. And Alan Lomax, if you can imagine, he's going through the Jim Crow South in his time, you know, and God, who even knows what his father was going through, but they're recording black artists in the South at a time where, you know, I mean, I don't need to explain to the audience what happened in the South in his, you know, 20th century time period. I mean, it was not pretty, and there was a lot of history there that you wouldn't see if it wasn't for those people, because you know, they were dealing with their own form of censorship there, and issues with platforms and what they were able to sell and show, and what, you know, stories like how Alan Lomax got Leadbelly out of prison. You know, him and his father went and recorded Leadbelly while he was in jail, and the story goes, I don't know if it's true, they went to the warden and had Leadbelly play the warden a song and got him released from prison. Or maybe it was the governor, Pat Morris, Neff.
Yeah.
But
I heard
stuff
that story.
Like that. So
I didn't
nothing
know.
New under the sun.
I heard that story. I didn't know that Alan Lomax was involved with it, though. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they're the ones who got him out.
Hmm. Wow. Awesome. Love Leadbelly.
I don't think it's that easy anymore.
No, probably not. no, that unless it's like a Disney movie. But yeah. Okay, well, look, I guess that's disheartening to hear that your situation with YouTube or just online presence in general is kind of at the whims of these situations that are more tenuous than they may appear. Is there a plan B? Is there another platform or another mode of communication that you think people need to start looking at?
It's interesting that you say that, you know, because look, I haven't had a ton of problems. I can't claim to have a lot of problems with YouTube. It is a little vague is the best way to put it as far as what's allowed and what you can get away with. I mean, we're in changing times. That goes for everything as monetization, rights and copyright and everything. It's a very strange world we live in, strange times we live in. But as far as a backup goes, I just started a Patreon, you know, and a lot of artists nowadays, and I would recommend it for a lot of artists to have those multiple revenue streams. Patreon, for people that don't know, is a website created by creators that allows people that do creative work to have their audience pay them monthly, which sounds like it isn't very novel, but if you haven't noticed, for the past decade or two, we've been really expecting to get digital content by creators for free. It's been held hostage by a revenue model that relies on advertisers. You know, same thing goes for Spotify. If you're wondering why it takes a million, you know, plus listens to get a living wage on Spotify for artists, it's because they rely on an advertising model. It's all controlled by one company, you know, and yeah, there's competition, but the competition acts in the same exact way. If you're an artist in this, you know, this decade, you know this struggle, you know this pain. Why is it that artists have to tour to make money? Why is it that touring is looked at as the big bucks for an artist? Well, it's because they're not getting their fair wages on streaming. They're not getting their fair wages on the internet. The internet's the Wild West still. I mean, it's you know, as long as it's been around, we think it's been around forever. It's only been around for so many years, you know. 20 years is since the dot-com boom, which is, you know, and that's in my lifetime. You know, I'm a millennial. I'm not really, I sound like I'm really old saying that, but, you know, it's been around most of my life, but that's not a long time. So there's still going to be a lot of time where we see this evolve and artists find new ways, which they should. There's so many people we can connect to online with our art that it doesn't make sense not to ask those people for funding directly instead of leaving it up to these huge corporations to collect these, you know, millions and millions of dollars on our behalf, and then you just, what, rely on them to give it back to us? That's never worked in the history of mankind, and I think you're going to see a lot more new pseudo-unionizing between artists, which I think we should do.
That's an interesting idea. So pseudo-unionizing, I mean, like, we're talking about, like, you know, collective groups that are, what, for lack of a better term, lobbying or otherwise demanding the fair wage, the proper compensation from company. Like, how does that look?
Look here, you know, I romanticize as a folk musician and a folk appreciative person about the state of the unions in the 20th century. I mean, it was a beautiful thing when people really came together. But the world has changed, and labor isn't the same, especially not in the creative field. And I don't think you're going to see so much of all of these people coming together to demand more, although you do, and we just had a big decision brewing in Congress and Senate about the whole new digital, I forget the name of the bill, but Joe Pug has a great plug about it on his podcast if you want to learn a little bit about it. But basically ASCAP and everybody came together with the streaming platforms trying to work out royalties, which have been severely antiquated in this new age. But I think what you're going to see is a lot of people not unionizing in the traditional way, but coming together with new ideas, like Patreon. Patreon is an amazing new idea that people are still experimenting with and finding out how to work it exactly. But it is the future, I think, ways like that. You know, once people start realizing and getting fed up with these giant corporations that hog all the bandwidth, we're going to start trying to do what Americans have always done, and that's really get entrepreneurial with it and make our own apps, make our own platforms. We just need practical ways to do it, and that's coming. I'll tell you what, that's it's not here yet, but who knows what the next 10 years will be. Maybe next year you'll be sitting with your Oculus Rift 3D headset on watching a show that an artist puts on in their living room in 3D. You know, who knows?
Okay, well, I look forward to your Oculus stream in the future. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, though. I think, you know, I guess there's not just one alternative. There's not going to be one other way. Maybe that's the whole point, is that there's got to be a multiplicity of revenue or streams, a multiplicity of solutions, a little bit from Patreon, a little bit from traditional ads, a little bit from door-to-door. I mean, that could be the democratizing the revenue might democratize the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. But just to rewind a little bit to what you were saying about just the content and the rights of it. You know, I remember, like, back in the early days, the Napster era. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm a millennial too, but we millennials, we're damn old now, you know?
Yeah, we are.
So, you know, the argument then and for a couple years thereafter seemed to be really tilted in favor of of the people who wanted the music to be free, and was like, you know, there was a lot of, like, anti-corporate, like, rhetoric in terms of, oh, these artists are making so much money, it doesn't matter. We just want to be able to share MP3s. All we're doing is sharing. We're not stealing. Like that was, like, the first narrative. And then it seems to have kind of shifted a bit now towards a little bit more what you were saying, but just once streaming services kind of replaced piracy, really, as far as I could tell, that now everybody's not so happy about the compensation levels there. And I think that's a totally fair argument. But I do find it interesting that the tenor of the conversation has now swung back towards artist rights and artist ownership of content and being able to demand compensation for it, as opposed to in 2001 when everybody just wanted to get on LimeWire or Napster or Kazaa.
Exactly. It is interesting. You're absolutely right. I think that is, it's a, look, I'm a student of history, okay? And like I said, nothing new under the sun. Now, for the past 100 years in the 20th century, what was the music industry doing? They were practicing physical item sales. Now, they started with records. They worked on the cassettes. They went on to CDs. And by the 21st century, the turn of the 21st century, the music industry was mature. I mean, that was 100 years they had to get it right, and they did get it right, and artists were getting paid big bucks. And when that changed with digital products, it's naive to think that digital products are somehow sharing. You know, all that a CD is that digital product on a physical item, because it had to be. There is no difference in sharing MP3s. And now I can't claim to have read a lot of the literature around those pirates and the left, the, you know, that whole world of pirating and the Scandinavian mindset, the pirate party. I don't know too much about that, but I do think that you're just seeing an evolution, right? I mean, it's going from free-for-all to, all right, we have this platform now where we're monetizing Spotify, etc. And now you're seeing the artists going, okay, but we want a little bit more. And they were doing the same thing in the 20th century, you know. At first, it was a free-for-all. It was radio. Radio was new. You know, now suddenly, wait a second, we can get our songs out to all these people? Because folk music was very different before then. Folk music was, there were no copyrights. You would have floating verses in songs, you know. One person would pick up a song, change it a little bit, and play it himself. There was no concept of a song being one way or another. There was a totally different philosophy of looking at music. And with recorded music in the 20th century, once they started pressing it to, you know, wax cylinders, suddenly you could play a song in somebody's living room. This is how this band played it. Well, that just must be how it is. That's their song. You can't copy that now. You know, and things changed and they evolved from there. I mean, there's so much history here that you could dig into, but we are definitely just seeing a new evolution of the same old game here.
Yeah, and it seems like part of the thought during that transition was that the reason that artists couldn't get a break was because they were gatekeepers towards discovering their music. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get on the radio, they couldn't get heard, they couldn't get their music videos on MTV. And so I think the reason people kind of shrugged off the Napster file sharing Pirate Bay situation initially was because they figured, well, exposure will save us. We just get the music out there, people will hear it, the good stuff will rise to the top, and we'll, you know, meritocracy happens. But I feel like what's happening now and what's happened in the past few years is that people have realized, okay, it wasn't that simple. We're still not getting paid. We still aren't seeing the money, even though we're out there. And it seems like a place like Gems Like VHS occupies an interesting space in between all of that, because you are providing exposure for people, but you do have these financial concerns, and you are working the streams, the financial streams, income streams, for yourself as well as the artists.
Yeah, you know, the financial side of it all is something that I walked into secondary. I did it first for the love of it. I didn't make a dime on the YouTube channel for the first 6 years, and that's all there is to it. And now there is a little advertising money. It's just like Spotify. You got to have 1 million views before I make any amount of money that matters, you know. I'm getting the same royalty checks the artists are, where it comes in, you know, and I'm getting like 10 cents, you know, and you're looking at that check like, oh, well, that's cool, why'd they even bother me, you know, why'd they even bother putting that to print? But it's a weird world, and I try to just give a platform for the artists to do what they want to do, you know. I try to reach an audience and give them another place where they can sell. I'm trying to build an audience that likes, appreciates, I should say, the same thing that I do. And I think that we can give a lot of equity to artists that otherwise wouldn't be able to get it. You know, these guys can't get on the radio, they can't get on, they don't have the representation to get on Spotify, they don't have the ability to, or the resources to hire a video person to come out and do a great video. And that's where we step in. You know, I don't charge any of these artists to make the Gems on VHS videos. I just come out and do it, you know, and I don't know if they're going to get a million views and I'm ever going to make any, you know, advertising money on it. But I do it because I do it for the audience and I do it for the artist.
And all that said, you're not just doing it for anybody. I think you've got a great curatorial approach to who you choose to work with and what you choose to do. And wondering if you can elaborate a little bit about, like, if someone comes to Gems on VHS, what kind of artists are they going to find there? What kind of personalities are going to be out?
I'm not looking for personalities so much as I am. I have an archetype that I'm looking for,
archetype,
right?
I have
a person I'm looking for. I'm looking for honest songwriters. I'm looking for songwriters that have something to say, that aren't writing for the wrong reasons. You know, a lot of people, which is fine, you know, people want to be entertained by music, and that's all well and good. You know, I'm not going to sit here and knock Taylor Swift for wanting to be a superstar. But there's definitely a type of music out there that is written by people who really just write because there's no way they can't. They do it because they have to. You know, and they've dedicated their lives to being artists. That's the other thing that's really important. You know, there's a lot of people that reach out to me that they might want to be on the channel, they might want this or that, but look, if you, I'm not going to say I won't consider you, but if you haven't dedicated your entire life to it, you're up against some really stiff competition for time and airplay. You know, bands like Lost Dog Street Band, people like Hayden Karchmer, Hill Country Devil, people like Casper Allen, Esther Rose, all these people, they work really hard, full-time almost, to write. Writing is their life. Music is their life. That's what they do. They do it because they have to. And that's what I'm looking for when I choose people to represent on the channel. You know, I'm looking for people who I know the audience is going to enjoy. Their talent is there. But also that they're just all the way committed. Because I'm all the way committed. And I don't want to spend my time recording anybody who isn't all the way there.
Yeah. Do you do any playing, any songwriting?
Oh, do I do any songwriting? I live in Nashville, okay? If I didn't
right.
do any songwriting, then I would be an alien. I mean, I write songs, I play a lot of banjo. People ask me all the time why I don't put myself on the channel, and I just tell them, it's not about me.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I can't think of anything worse than trying to up myself onto my own YouTube channel. It'd be weird.
Yeah, no, banjo is a good choice though.
I love it.
Yeah. So what's next for Gems on VHS? Is it just kind of keep trucking along as is, or any secret plans in the works?
Secret plans. Well, you know, I don't keep many secrets, but we do have a new Patreon that we started, and I've talked a little bit about my philosophy with that. I was really reluctant to start the Patreon at first, but a lot of our audience would comment and tell me, hey, is there any way I can get involved? And they'd say, hey, I want to contribute to a Patreon. You should get a Patreon. And I didn't know at first, but I decided, look, if people want more from this project, who am I to tell them no? So I started one, and I guess our next step is to expand. I mean, we've had a few contributors already. I just started it recently, and I'm really excited about it. And from there, we're going to try and move into a direction that's kind of more of a traditional record label. We're going to release vinyl and CDs one day, and we're going to record some of these artists, get them in the studio, and actually do proper recordings. And we're going to do more videos, importantly. Hopefully we'll be able to release a lot more because of that.
That's great to hear. Well, I hope you're able to continue with the philosophy of the democratization of this process. I don't know if that's the right term, but that seems to be a concept that we've been dancing around.
I like that.
Here.
I'm going to have to write that down.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Patreon thing makes sense. You know, people, like you say, they want to contribute. They want to be part of what you're doing, and they want to feel a little sense of ownership over that. And if that means a few bucks your way, then, you know, everybody wins. And, I mean, you know, if you're able to take that over into the whole recording industry aspect, too, I'm excited to see how it goes.
thanks to Anthony Simpkins for joining us today on The Abstract. You can and should check out his video work with Gems on VHS at their official YouTube channel and support them via their Patreon page. You can find links in the description below. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again soon, next time on The Abstract.